Hello and welcome to National League Town, Mets fandom, Mets history, Mets life, with Long Island's own Greg Prince and Jeff Heisen. Hey, Greg.
Hey, Jeff, I'm giving you the Tommy Cutlets greeting with the fingers here. Nobody can see it. Tommy DeVito, my new hero. Hi, how are you?
Player of the week, along with Zach Wilson, is a sentence that I never thought that I would ever say.
New York is a football town at last.
On today's show, we remember the legacy of Mrs. Payson. But first, to me, the Mets suffered a huge blow this week as they lost Ronnie Mauricio for the season. For the second straight year, the Mets have lost a player for the upcoming season due to an injury in international competition. Mauricio was playing third base. He stopped and started as a base runner and tore his ACL. Again, to me, this is huge news. During the winter meetings, David Stern said that he was satisfied with the Mets' internal candidates for third base. He cited Mauricio, Beatty, Fientos, and newcomer Joey Wendell. Well, Mauricio's gone. To me, Mauricio was the clear front runner because of his power, his versatility, and his base running. Unlike the others, he can run. The Mets severely lacked players that could go from first to third, take the extra base. I saw a statistic that said the Mets were one of the worst teams in baseball at that. And while Fientos and Beatty need a rest stop to get from first to third, Mauricio could do it easily, and I was looking forward to him playing third base. This is a huge loss for the Mets. There are external options, but none of them are as good as Mauricio. I'm very upset about this. Greg, am I overstating this?
You always overstate it, Jeff, but I understand the emotional reaction because you don't expect to lose a potentially important player in the middle of December. I don't know where Mauricio would have played necessarily. I'm sure they were looking at him third base. I liked the way he played second base last year, which gave you some flexibility in terms of sending McNeil to the outfield and perhaps some other trades down the line. Who knew? This puts a crimp in it. It's to me, it's rough because he's one of the players I was looking forward to seeing just based on that 1 month of action. It has been a very quiet till now off season in a proactive sense for the Mets. And I was trying to think of things to look forward to. And number one for me was Francisco Alvarez continuing on in his progress. And number two was Ronnie Mauricio. Again, based on one promising, interesting month and everything we knew about him coming in. Yeah, you referred to this as international competition, maybe not exactly what that is, because, I mean, the WBC, you know, a contrived tournament, we both sort of think, and something that was invented in our lifetimes, or, you know, certainly within the last 20 years, so we're not that impressed by it, despite whatever it has going for it. So when we lost Edwin Diaz, it's like, what was he doing here? You know, the Dominican Winter Leagues and the Caribbean Leagues, it's a different story. They've been doing that forever. There's a question of whether a major league player needs to be honing his skills in that kind of competition versus just working out. Although players have been playing in winter leagues for years and this doesn't happen. And the play where it happened, you know, again, it wasn't as bizarre as with Edwin Diaz jumping up and down and suddenly, oh my God, he's just on the base path, first to second. Not even at full speed, making me think that would have this happened under some other circumstance, whether it was in spring training or whether he's bringing the groceries in from the car or something where he lives. I don't know. Bottom line is it's not good. Not good for the Mets, not good for Mauricio, not good for his progress, not good for third base, not good for the lineup, not good for the speed of the team. And this is an understanding that Mauricio, I don't think, is a finished product. Maybe that's why he has to hone his skills in the winter league. I'm not sure. Again, you wish, you know, everybody, as the cliche goes, is bubble wrapped through the winter and nothing happens to them this looked sort of like with Diaz, but in just sort of regular competition, kind of freakish. I don't think anybody expects a guy taking off from first base to suddenly just go down like he did. So I guess, yeah, third base is now, as Mets fans have said since 1962, more often than not, third base is a question mark.
They'll look at external options with Justin Turner, Matt Chapman, Josh Donaldson, and hope that Beatty and Vientos can improve. Shohei Ohtani signed a $700 million contract with the Dodgers. The first headline was that he wasn't going to the Blue Jays. He wasn't on that plane. He signed with the Dodgers. The second headline was the amount of the contract. And the third headline was the amount of deferred money. So much was deferred that his $700 million contract will not, in and of itself, cause the Dodgers to go above the luxury tax. It feels wrong that Steve will have to pay a luxury tax, and the Mets were penalized 10 spots in the draft in part for the salary of two players who will play for other teams, while the Dodgers will not pay the luxury tax for someone that is playing on the Dodgers and has a bigger contract than those two players. Something seems wrong about it. The Dodgers did nothing wrong. In fact, it was kind of clever, but it's still surprising and somewhat upsetting to me.
You are caffeinated this morning, I have to say. First off, nobody has had a better Hanukkah than Shohei Ohtani. You might even say it's Ohtanika. In Southern California, at least up in Los Angeles, maybe not down in Orange County. Somebody did their research, figured out how to pull this off in terms of his contract, make it as palatable and within the regulations as possible. So, yeah, good for them. Good for Ohtani. Good for the Dodgers. Not so good for the Mets when they have to face the Dodgers, perhaps. Yeah, I don't really understand what's a penalty, what isn't. You haven't even really thought about it too much, about why the Mets got penalized, now the Dodgers won't, deferred payments and all of that. I feel bad for Blue Jays fans mostly. I guess Angels fans too, though they were probably ready for this to happen. Blue Jays fans being told on the Friday, I guess, that, oh, he's on a plane. Absolutely. Oh, he's not on a plane. And then the next day we learn that, no, he's going to the Dodgers. You really wonder, again, they had a strike about this when the owners tried to institute a salary cap, and it never took. The luxury tax penalties exist sort of as a curb in place of a salary cap. But you wonder, with all the other sports having had salary caps, you know, is there going to be a push now from the markets that can't do this, even though, you know, again, nobody should be crying for MLB owners. If there's going to be a push for some sort of mechanism to keep teams from doing this. In the meantime, yeah, Ohtani, Freeman, Betts, wasn't too long ago, none of them were Dodgers. No, all of them are Dodgers. A team that's pretty good to begin with, not so great in the postseason. But they get there, and they have a very good chance of getting back there. Tough blow to, I was reading this morning, the Giants. You know, they made a pitch. The Dodgers are their arch rivals, and they think they have a lot to offer, and the Dodgers just, you know, kind of steamroll their division, even though the division was represented by the Diamondbacks in the World Series. So you never know how these things are going to go. But, you know, it was, I'll say this as a baseball fan, not as a Mets fan. It was kind of exciting for one day that it felt like the whole sports world, at least, was talking about baseball in the middle of December, as opposed to everything else that's actually in season. And it certainly knocked aside the Juan Soto news that he was coming to New York, but not to the part of New York we enjoy. So, you know, yeah, I don't know that it's good for baseball. It says good things about baseball, but it's bad for baseball. It's bad for competition. I just know that he's not an Angel anymore. He's a Dodger. And happy Ohtanika.
instead of 8 crazy nights, he has 10 crazy years with the Dodgers. While the Mets wait on Yoshinobu Yamamoto to make a decision, the Mets still have to improve their starting pitching, and they have done so incrementally with Luis Severino and Jorge Lopez. Severino, a reclamation project, who signed a one-year contract. Jorge Lopez, fantastic in 2022, was an all-star, terrible in 23. We'll see what the Mets get in 24. As far as hitters, we're still waiting. Joey Wendell replaces Luis Guillorme as the dual catch-all infielder, and Jose Iglesias was signed as well. The Mets are going to be signing a lot of relievers. They've signed Michael Tonkin, Austin Adams, Kyle Crick, and they've signed others. Michael Tonkin is an interesting name because of his background and what he did last year. He pitched okay for the Twins. Then he went to Japan. Then he came back to the United States. Then he pitched in the minors. He pitched in the Atlantic League. He pitched in the Mexican League. And somehow he ended up with the Braves last year and was part of their bullpen for the entire season. He was Brian Snitker's go-to long man per The Athletic, finishing second among NL relievers in innings pitched and recording more than three outs in two-thirds of his appearances. So he wasn't great, but he was there, and he could pitch a lot, and that's something the Mets lacked. So Michael Tonkin will be someone to look at as we wait for the Mets to make more off-season moves.
Yeah, most of these guys, we've approached them with what kind of puns can we make out of their last names or perhaps their first names, because we don't really know a whole lot else about them. But, of course, that's what the baseball season is for. The Mets have put together effective benches and effective bullpens, or at least passable bullpens and benches, based on guys who I said to myself, who is this again, when they've gotten him. So it's only fair to give each of these players the benefit of the doubt, because they are professionals and they will have their chance to impress somebody. You know, the Mets aren't by any means in a rebuild, and they're not exactly in a reboot, but it does feel, especially with the new front office, of course, a new manager, new coaching staff, that there is sort of a half a house cleaning has gone on. You know, they let a bunch of secondary players go, and only a couple of them were names that non-Mets fans would know, and some Mets fans have probably forgotten some of those who left. And now this is the other side of it. And, you know, again, for a team that lost 87 games last year, you can't blame them for just wanting to say, okay, let's bring in guys who might have something that we've scouted, that we've looked at their interior numbers or whatever, and say, you know, this is somebody who, you know, can get an inning and take care of, pick up a ground ball if we have to make a switch or something. I was going to say a double switch. We don't really see double switches anymore, or at least not very often. So, you know, I guess, you know, the less exciting part of all of this is we've become conditioned, especially the last couple of years, to thinking, oh boy, it's the off season and Steve Cohen has no bounds on his appetite and his resources. So let's go. And it just hasn't worked in that way this winter. There is also a tendency to say when the Mets do make a lot of news, oh, they're winning the offseason. What good does that do them? You know, nobody's ever happy. You know, offseason's got a ways to go. So half of December, January, into February, and you never know, spring training. And I have to remind myself of that sometimes because I get a little antsy. And say, oh boy, you know, why aren't we signing this guy or that guy? And yeah, and the one big guy out there who we're all waiting on is Yamamoto. Guy I've never seen pitch except in little clips on the internet showing me how devastating this or that pitch is. But I will take everybody's word for it that that's the guy we want. And perhaps with what happened to Mauricio, there will be a little more reaching out to those who are on the open market. Not an exciting offseason to date. I mean, unfortunately, the biggest news is what happened to Mauricio, and that's the kind of news you never want to hear. And before that, yeah, Luis Severino, sort of the headline guy of all these people the Mets have brought in. And I didn't even realize just how inactive or ineffective he's been for a few years. And again, I feel like I'm back a couple of years ago in that let's get Michael Wacha and Rick Porcello in here and see what they have, which could work out Severino-wise, but it's not like, ooh, you know, we've now got our number two starter for sure. So we hate to do it, especially when we've had our caffeine, but we have to be a little patient, I guess.
It's hard to be patient when you have Steve Cohen. We were forced to be patient with the Wilpons. We expected get this guy, get that guy, and other teams have money too. We wanted Juan Soto, but the Mets weren't going to diminish the minor leagues that they've built up so hard last August for a one-year contract. So again, we're patient, we hit refresh, and we hope for the best.
We should have traded Mauricio for Soto.
and then put Soto in bubble wrap.
Yes, absolutely. No, listen, Mauricio hopefully has a long career ahead of him. This is it's a big deal injury, but it's not the end of his career. So again, I hate patience as much as you do, but unfortunately, we do not have the ear of the owner or the president of baseball operations. Even if we did, they're going to do what they're going to do, and I'm sure there's a long game here, and it's December.
In December was the Queens Baseball Convention, and without overstating it, one of my favorite things that Greg does is his involvement at the Queens Baseball Convention with the Gil Hodges Unforgettable Fire Award. Once again, Greg was involved this year as the great Mrs. Joan Payson was honored.
That was a lot of fun. It's always a lot of fun at the QBC. It's evolved a little bit over the years. Now it takes place in a hotel ballroom or two in Flushing. So it really is the Queens Baseball Convention. For those who are not familiar with it, it has that name because it's not officially a Mets product. So they're careful not to use the Mets name, but it's a Mets fan fest, essentially. And the one part of it that I am involved in is the presentation of that award, originally conceived to kind of keep Gil Hodges' name out there, just so current and future generations would have a reason to hear about him at least once a year if they came to this convention, they read about it or heard about it. And we hoped maybe in some very small way have something to do with keeping him viable for the Hall of Fame, which he should have been in ages before. And of course, he made the Hall of Fame, which is, you know, something we're still very proud of. I don't mean from the QBC, just as Mets fans. I'm still feel warm all over from the unforgettable fire of that announcement a couple of years ago. Anyway, QBC tries to honor a member of the family, important person in the scheme of Mets fandom, Mets baseball, putting the Mets on the map, pushing the Mets cause forward. And this year, the decision was made to honor the late Mrs. Payson. And I thought it was a wonderful idea. Mrs. Payson, first owner of the New York Mets, 1962 to 1975, until she passed away. It fell into her family's hands. The team did. Not at a great time. Not a great time for the family. Time of transition in baseball. Maybe it was not the ownership to meet the moment, and they sold in 1980 to a group led by Nelson Doubleday and a minority owner named Fred Wilpon, and the rest is a different kind of history. But I think Mrs. Payson, it's honored not just for getting the Mets off the ground, but for being a woman who owned a baseball team when that was probably inconceivable, the way sports was operated in the early 60s and for many decades before then. And you know, Mrs. Payson was not a hands-on owner. She was a huge fan, and she had the resources, again, pre-free agency, pre-large contracts and rights fees and everything else, a different time. But she could afford to bring National League Baseball back to New York, and it was a priority for the woman because she grew up a huge New York Giants fan, enough so that she bought a small stake in the Giants. As she liked to say, I grew up in the polo grounds. That's where she spent her summers. Like so many young people, maybe she came at it from a different angle, but loved baseball, loved keeping score, all those things. Wanted to keep the Giants in New York, tried to buy the Giants to keep them from moving. Couldn't do it. Well, not only next best thing, maybe even a better thing, start my own team. Or at least when some people who were organizing the idea of a New York team in the National League, because we were without for a few years, they went to Mrs. Payson and she said, I can get behind that, and you know, left it to others to do the day by day. But she was always present and something of an inspirational figure, probably more than was realized at the time. You know, when I did my presentation for the award, I did it in conjunction with a lovely woman named Laurie Rubinson, who has a show on WFAN. And she talked about how important it was to her as a kid growing up, little girl, seeing the Mets are owned by a woman. And you can be in sports, you can be involved in some way, even though it's all guys playing out on the field. And I have to imagine that meant a lot to a lot of little girls growing up as Mets fans in the 60s and 70s. And it's probably not something that should be understated. And you know, those were good times for the Mets, and maybe not the beginning in terms of the record. But again, this was a family operation, a family feel to it, and a fun place to be. Mets games, the Polo Ground, Shea Stadium in the early years. And a team was being built, a franchise was being built. And the farm system was being built. They weren't trading everybody away. And of course, we got a world championship. We got another pennant out of it. And you can't say that Mrs. Payson's ownership was anything but an incredible success. So when it came time to give this Gil Hodges Unforgettable Fire Award and recognize Mrs. Payson, it was just a matter of who was going to accept. And I'm very happy that the guys who run QBC, Dan Twohig and Keith Blacknick specifically, they reached out to Mrs. Payson's descendants, and several people came. Chief among them, well, I shouldn't say chief among them, there are only a few of them, but Dan DeRoulet, well, we'll recognize the last name DeRoulet, her great-grandson, accepted the award officially. And Joanne Payson, who married Joan's son, no longer with us, unfortunately, son John, I believe. She's her daughter-in-law, and I got to spend some time with her before making my presentation. Lovely woman, great-grandson, very delightful young man. A couple of other relatives as well. And you just got the sense in talking to them how much this meant to them. And I wasn't really sure if people for whom something like this has been outside the family for more than 40 years, and these people are younger, or you know, in Joanne's case, she didn't marry Joan's son till after the Mets were no longer part of the Payson family. So maybe it was just, oh, what's that again? But no, they very much Mets fans. And very much, you know the legend and love the legend and enjoy the stories, and you know, felt forgotten to a great degree, because honestly, what was there to remember them by if nobody was doing anything like this? And certainly in the years that went by under previous ownership, other than I can only think of two times that the Payson legacy was even nodded toward. At the end of Shea Stadium, when they were bringing out, before they brought out all the players to say to Shea goodbye, as the phrase went, they brought out some special guests, and one of them was Linda DeRoulet, or Lorinda. And she was also known, who was Jones' daughter, who ran the Mets in not a great period, where, you know, let's just say the resources weren't there at the time, and the sale was inevitable. But she showed up, and, you know, Howie introduced her, Howie Rose, in 2008. And then when Citi Field opened, you know that there's, you know, a Stengel entrance, a Hodges entrance, a Seaver entrance. There was one door marked Payson, a small, like almost a VVIP entrance. As I discovered, that's what it was for. If you were like a super high roller, you came in through here to get whatever it was you got to get into the ballpark. Sort of like going through the kitchen at the Copa in Goodfellas, which was fun. Fun to see like a kind of a wink there, but that's not exactly a way of saying, hey, everybody. You know, this was the first owner of the team, the biggest fan the team had. And God knows she was a huge Mets fan. I loved sharing some of the stories. I mean, some of them I've read a lot. Some of them I found while doing a little bit of extra research for this. I loved that the family remembered these stories. I mean, one of them was in 1969, and Mrs. Payson has you know, had plenty of places to stay. Let's put it that way. She had a house in Maine for the summer, and she's up there, and it's 1969, and she doesn't want to miss the Mets, and she doesn't have it MLB.TV or anything like that. She made an arrangement with the local TV station to air Mets games in that town, in Maine. I don't know how much of it had covered, but that summer, you could watch the Mets on channel whatever in Maine because Mrs. Payson paid them. The most famous story regarding her fandom and what it was like to be a Mets fan in 1962. Again, she's taking off for Europe in the midst of the season. And she left instructions like, wire me the results. Cable me, whatever that people would say back then, because again, couldn't text. And everyone was a loss because it was 1962. And finally, she said, listen, just wire me, send me a cable when they win. She didn't get any cable because it was 1962. And I watched the reactions of her family who came to QBC, and they laughed, they nodded. Some of this they'd grown up on or had inherited the stories. And some of it was new to them. Great story. And this is one that I got from our friend Dave Bagdade's book about the 62 Mets. You know, that there was a team dinner in spring training in 62. And Mrs. Payson was, quite frankly, going to be one of the boys. And they go to a restaurant and a steakhouse, and she orders a steak. And the waitress asks Mrs. Payson, how would you like that done? And she says, just cut off its horns, wipe its ass, and put it on a plate. And, you know, not what you would think of necessarily from a society matron, but, you know, she could have fun. Right now, at Citi Field, there is a speakeasy, they call it. We don't have prohibition, but it's sort of like that. It's not exactly open to the public, but it's there. It's known. They made a big announcement about a year ago, you know, called the Cadillac Club at Payson's. Never mind, that has to be sponsored. And when I was talking to Mrs. Payson's daughter-in-law, Joanne, she said she would love that because she said, are you familiar with Toots Shores? I said, of course, you know, Toots Shores, the great, you know, the bar where everybody who was anybody went for years, especially from the world of sports. And she, well, Mrs. Payson, patron of Toots Shores. So, you know, her bona fides as a sports person, a sportswoman, if you will. Absolutely, 100%. And, you know, again, not a woman who ever really wanted attention. So in a way, it's not terrible that her name isn't all over the place at Citi Field, but probably should be somewhere. And, you know, go watch on YouTube, if you like, the Met Clubhouse celebration after the World Series. And you know how it's always a little off-putting, I think. When they give the commissioner's trophy to the owner, you know, you talk about in other sports, other countries, you know, give it to the captain, the trophy, do it and give the Stanley Cup to the captain. But in other American sports, it's like, hey, here comes the great capitalist. Let's give the capitalist, the owner, the trophy. And Mrs. Basin, was part of that presentation, and she's like, oh, thank you very much. And then she just like gets off stage right away and is just telling Gil Hodges, don't trip on the platform over there. And that's all. That was it. She wanted other people to be happy, wanted Mets fans to be happy. And we were a happy bunch. Especially when we were winning. Just set a great tone. I'm really happy to say that kind of serving as escort for her relatives on during QBC. They were referring to a, oh, there's Josh. I didn't realize it was Josh Cohen, Steve and Alex Cohen's son. Apparently they have been, or at least I don't know if it was triggered by this, or there's people know people, but they've been in touch, and it's almost a welcoming back into the Met family from the Cohens to the Paysons and De Roulets. And I was thinking a little bit, you're a big fan of Frasier, as I am. I was thinking of that episode where they go on Antiques Roadshow and they think they have a clock, or they find out they have a clock that is from the lost Russian dynasty. And for about 5 minutes, Frasier and Niles think that they are related to the Tsar. And they find out differently because it's a great situation comedy. And I was thinking of that while I was talking to the Paysons and the De Roulets, because it's almost like lost royalty here. But they haven't been at sea. They weren't in exile. They just, the team just was sold. And but they're still a part of it. That's what I love. That's what's great about QBC. Everybody's a part of the Mets family. And I just felt it so much. I got chills, honestly, hearing, stories about the Paysons, about Joan Payson and the people she knew, and the things that have obviously been told again and again within their households. And they sell, there's people who put up tables for merchandise and collectibles and whatever at QBC. And before they left, they picked up a Christmas ornament that said Mets on it. So we're bringing it to Linda, meaning Linda De Roulet, Joan's daughter, still not able to come to something like this, but still living on Long Island, still on the North Shore. And they were going to see her the next day. I'm like, oh, we're bringing her a Mets Christmas ornament for a tree. But so I was like, oh my God, that's so wonderful. They care enough. It's still a part of them. And if this played a small role in making them feel that, their mother-in-law, great-grandmother, whatever the relationship would be, is still remembered, it's still valued. And people definitely were appreciative in the audience of hearing about Mrs. Payson. And you have a lot of people there who were around then, as kids, but you also have people who are, next generations. They maybe know the name, and the chance to put the story out there a little bit. Yeah, great honor for me to do every year, especially this year. Great job by the QBC folk. Happy to be a part of it.
I like that we remembered her because I think she's a forgotten person in sports history. This is a female sports team owner in the 60s. Why aren't we making documentaries about her? Why isn't there a movie based on her life? It seems to me that this should have been done by now.
I mean, all I can think is that because she shied away from publicity, she once said, I don't know why people act like I'm something special. I'm just a fan, which is kind of, again, understating the case. I imagine a Mrs. Payson movie would kind of have that 42 feel to it, where they might play up certain aspects that didn't really happen, but would get the message across. But that said, yeah, I think an underrecognized historical figure, not only in the Met world, but in the baseball world. And a few people have mentioned, why isn't she in the Hall of Fame? Not the Mets Hall. She was the first half of the first Hall of Fame class, she and Casey Stengel, in the Mets Hall of Fame in 1981, which, again, that was recognition in the early years of Doubleday and Wilpon. It's a big story historically. And you can't really tell the story of baseball in New York without her. We wouldn't be talking about the Mets had somebody not just been the first owner, but somebody who really put her heart and soul into it. And I often say about Casey Stengel, without Casey Stengel, we're the Houston Cold 45s, but with a worse record. There's something, I think, to be said for a large personality and a large enthusiasm. And, you know, not just, it wasn't just an asset on a balance sheet somewhere. Baseball was important to this woman. And again, like you said, a woman owning a baseball team, it would still be, you know, considered a little unusual today in professional sports, but not unheard of. But in 1962, this, I think, should have been news more so probably than it was, other than saying, oh, that's the lady who owns the team. Here's Don Grant or George Weiss or whoever who's running the show. You don't own a team for 14 seasons and not have an outsized impact on its fortunes. Again, this award, small thing, but I'm glad it happened. I'm glad it happened. I mean, it'd be wonderful if she enjoyed accolades like these in life, and I hope she did. But it's I think it's great that people want to do it years later, because it keeps somebody's name and legacy alive and keeps it obvious. I mean, her legacy is the Mets. And as her great-grandson said, in accepting the award, she would be very pleased with something like this. But said that her real award is all of you Mets fans here today. The fact that you all care so much about this baseball team. And we go on caring about this baseball team because there was one woman who cared a lot about having this baseball team exist. You know, I was talking earlier about Tommy DeVito, the light of my life now. And I was thinking about how, you know, players come along that you don't see coming along, and they make a great deal of difference for your team. And it's not necessarily the starting quarterback. Remember Bubbles Hawkins came to the Nets out of like nowhere the first year they were in the NBA and, like, you know, lit up the scoreboard for about half a season. DJ Stewart, this very last Nets season, we weren't expecting anything, and he gave us an incredible run. You know, who recently passed away, a player who was sort of the prototype for all of this from a Mets perspective, that guy who comes up from AAA, who maybe you've heard of, maybe you haven't, not really on the radar, and is just unstoppable for a little while. This man's name was Joe Hicks. Joe Hicks was a journeyman outfielder in the American League in the 50s and hadn't really gotten much of a shot. He had to go into the Army for a while, as players did, so may have lost some momentum. Was with the White Sox the year they won the pennant in 59, kind of a September call-up, so he didn't make the postseason roster. Later played for the Washington Senators, the expansion of Washington Senators. Remember, you had the Washington Senators, they moved to Minnesota, and you got new Washington Senators. I found this very confusing to pick up on when I first started reading about baseball history. Anyway, Joe Hicks had a chance in Washington, didn't work out with those Senators. The Mets get him going into the 1963 season, their second season coming off, again, the legendary but not particularly successful first season. Joe Hicks does not make it out of spring training in March or April. He goes down to Buffalo, which is where their AAA club was at the time, tears it up for a while, for a few months. Second half comes along there on a 10-game losing streak to start to end the first half. Get the All-Star game. Well, we're just going to continue our losing streak because we're 1963 Mets. It reaches 15, but they have added Joe Hicks a day or two into the second half of the season. Casey Stengel has nothing to lose. Says, I'm putting Joe Hicks in the lineup. I'm putting him in center field. Joe Hicks goes crazy. I don't mean literally, but from an offensive standpoint, he's hitting a home run every day, and the Mets start to win. And reading about Joe Hicks' Met arc, shall we say, really put me in mind. DJ Stewart, Benny Agbayani, remember when he came up after a cup of coffee in 98, he comes up in May of 99, goes nuts. They're playing Benny and the Jets on the organ, or at least a recording of it on an organ at Shea Stadium. Mike Vail in 75, coming up in August. That's what it was like. Joe Hicks, and yeah, DJ Stewart. He wasn't the answer in the long term. but he had his best days as a New York Met. And he gave you some hope as a New York Met for a few weeks. You know, he comes up and it's just sort of, you know, diamond dust. You remember those little ellipsis columns that would be at the end of stories, like, oh, and the Mets are calling up outfielder Joe Hicks. By the end of the week, by the end of the month, they're doing full-blown profiles on Joe Hicks in the New York and New Jersey papers. And you're reading about him in the sporting news, and Casey Stengel is praising him to the heavens. And Hicks, who's, you know, been through the ringer a bit at this point as a professional, he's over 30, which at that time was like, oh my God, a 30-year-old, says, you know, I just want to get a chance. I've never really had a chance before. And he gets his chance. He plays most of the rest of the 1963 season as a regular. The hitting 400 and the homer every day, it doesn't continue because it's not going to continue for anybody, really. And, you know, he plays, like I said, till the end of 63. He has the honor. If you're ever in a trivia contest, you want to know who hit the last left-handed home run at the Polo Grounds, it's Joe Hicks. Second to last game the Mets or anybody ever played there, at least as a regular season game. And after that, because this is just how baseball could be sometimes, Joe Hicks was kind of victim to a youth movement. Remember, the youth of America, that's what we were counting on. So Casey was counting on. And we moved to Shea Stadium, and the Mets are trying to get younger. And Joe Hicks gets sent down to start the next year. Because his stats weren't that great once the year was over, once that first burst of Joe Hickstam, if you will, comes and goes in July. And he, you know, plays his best in Buffalo, but doesn't get the call. And the way baseball teams exchange minor league franchises, Buffalo becomes a Reds AAA affiliate in 66. And he's still there. He's Buffalo's own at that point. But that becomes the last season of Joe Hicks' professional career, which dates back to 1953. And after a while, he goes home. He's from Virginia. We talked about Ron Hodges recently, another Virginian who we lost. And he has a nice long life. You know, he becomes an umpire, works for the Parks and Recreation Department of Virginia. He's ensconced. He's an important part of the community where he is. He gets awards from the Commonwealth of Virginia for all he has done to promote sportsmanship as an excellent umpire in several sports. And he stays married to the same woman for more than 60 years, who he met, by the way. We were talking about Winter League Baseball. It worked out well for Joe Hicks. Joe Hicks met his wife in Nicaragua in the 1958, heading into 1959 offseason. They got married on New Year's Eve, 1958. They stayed married till the end of his life. I believe she is still with us. So there's something to be said for Winter League Baseball. He managed he was still in the Mets system. He goes down to manage in Nicaragua that winter after he had made his debut. So he was already kind of looking ahead to life afterwards. So, you know, he wasn't in professional baseball, but he stayed involved in sports. It's important to him. And, you know, loving family, well-respected, admired man. I'm going to be honest. I didn't know a whole lot about Joe Hicks until I found out he passed away. He's a name to me on a list of Mets. And I had noticed some time ago that, oh, Joe Hicks is still with us. And my first thought is always, Joe Hicks is not Jim Hickman, because when I first saw Joe Hicks's name as a kid, or later maybe, I said, Hicks, you mean Hickman? Oh, Mets had a player named Joe Hicks. Well, sometimes, you know, it pays to look into these things. Good man from all indications, and a pretty good player. Maybe didn't get the chance he needed or deserved when he was younger. Maybe he would have been on a different path with the White Sox, you know, served his country. That interrupted what he was doing. And maybe it was just never going to be the same in baseball for him. But again, for that 1 week and that 1 month in 63, when the Mets, when, again, we know what it's like as fans. You want somebody to come along, especially when your team isn't doing that well. You want somebody to come along, lift your spirits, lift your eyes. Like, you mean we have a center fielder now? You mean we have a home run hitter now? Wow, Joe Hicks, you know, and you start in your mind, whether it's Joe Hicks or Mike Vail or DJ Stewart, you start penciling them in and thinking, okay, we're set. And you know, it doesn't always work out. But, you know, those are the guys who help make baseball fandom for us and the other sports too. You know, Tommy DeVito's and the Bubbles Hawkins and everybody else. So again, I'm sorry it took Joe Hicks's passing for me to show a little initiative and look up some things about Joe Hicks. But you know, it's one of those things where it's 60 years later, but it's like, I'm glad he was a Met and I'm glad he meant something to Mets fans when he did. And you know, thank you, Joe Hicks, for helping us out.
And thank you, Greg, for those beautiful words. Everyone that wore a Mets uniform is worth remembering. Our condolences to the friends and family of Joe Hicks. And that'll do it for this episode of National League Town. We'll be back next week with more. So until then, I'm Jeff Heisen.
I'm still making the Tommy DeVito thing with my hands because I'm just so excited. I'm Greg Prince.
And as always, let's go Mets. Copyright 2023, music provided by the Royal Arctic Institute. For tour dates and more, check them out on Bandcamp.